Because you're jumping back into the gap. All right, to coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game.
Before we start the podcast, I wanted to share a brief message from a recent member of Basketball Immersion. They wrote, I want to express my thanks to you for opening my eyes to a different way of teaching the game that I love so dearly. I joined in part to support the podcast work you do, as I know you put in countless hours. But I could have never imagined the depth of the website, the passion of your membership community to collaborate, and the impact it has made on how I coach. It's been an incredible experience for me, and I thank you. It was an incredible email to receive. And as your season starts, I would love for you, too, to join our Basketball Immersion community, not just in support of this podcast, but also in support of your coaching. Go to basketballimmersion.com to sign up.
Coach, is real treat today. Jota Cospinera is with us from Fuenlabrada, currently the head coach there. Tremendous background in basketball and a tremendous share of the game, which we'll get into, too, as well. But been an assistant coach with Real Madrid, been involved with the senior and all the development teams within the Spanish system. And again, most relevant and most recently, the head coach of Fuenlabrada. Coach, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
Great to have you. I think a real opportunity, so much curiosity around Spanish basketball. And I've got to say, definitely one of my favorite leagues to watch basketball from in the world. And Coach, can you give us an idea from your opinion of why Spanish basketball is so successful?
This is a difficult question because I don't really know myself, but I'm going to try to tell you what I think about it. When I was the coach for the national teams, the under 16 and under 18 national teams, I remember that on a lot of warming up drills before a game, I don't know, against France, against Lithuania, against different countries from all around the world. I was watching the warm-up and I said, how can we beat these guys? I mean, they're better physically. They're probably more skilled than we are. But I don't know why we have that kind of gene to compete. We're competitors. And probably that's because we compete since we are young. And we let our players solve a lot of their problems. We leave them a lot of space so they can find their own solutions to play. And probably that's one of the benefits of working this way, is that probably we're not as skilled as other players around the world, but when it comes into a court to try to compete, I think that then we have players that can compete with anybody. And how we do it is we give them the chances to take their own decisions on court.
Well, and that's such a huge part of development and creativity and all the things that I think coaches outside of Spain would look at and say, well, so many players that are creative, but that comes from freedom, right? And how is that reflected in practice, whether it's individual practice or team development, that development of this freedom?
Yeah, probably the first thing is that when they do something, but they don't achieve the goal, which is to get a basket, is we do not focus on the result, but in what they're doing, what they're trying to do. And if we find that they're trying to find a good solution, we let them try it again and again. And it doesn't matter if it's not our own solutions as coaches, but try to think as the way they're thinking as players. And if they're trying to find a solution themselves and we think that it can be good, we let them try different solutions by themselves instead of always telling them what to do. You see, so for sure, we tell them things to do, but we're not always saying, no, you got to do this and you cannot do this. It's try it. And if it works, do it. If it doesn't work, test something else. Okay? And you got to find your own way inside the court. So we leave them the freedom to, I don't know, when we start working with sets, the thing is, if you find an advantage, break it. I don't want to play the set because of the sake of playing the set. I want you to find an advantage. The goal of the set is to find an advantage. If you find an advantage earlier, you are free to break it. And you are free to break it on your own way. Just do it. Because we don't know if running the set at the end will give us the advantage we want. So anytime you have an advantage, take it and try it. try to score or try to do whatever you think it's better for the team at that moment?
Well, to me, this is a huge growth area for so many coaches. So I'm so glad you're saying it and you're saying it this way. And it's something I believe and something I share too, that too often coaches predetermine what a player should be doing, as opposed to giving them the opportunity to be able to make mistakes and develop within this freedom of creativity. So, Coach, this is great. And I know it's going to lead into our topic, which is going to discuss a little bit about how the game's changed and some of the things that, again, we predetermined still exist in the game. But the reality is, don't players teach us so much of how the game should be coached?
Sure. So every time, one of the big lessons in my life as a coach is that it's not you that matters, it's your players. If you think that you are the one that matters, then you're wrong. You're going to be as good or as bad as how much your players grow with you. And that's all. I mean, it doesn't matter the level you coach. It doesn't matter how big, how small, doesn't matter anything. You get the players at a certain point. They got a particular level. Your goal is to help them be better, whatever better means, okay? It can be score more. It can be defend better. It can be, I don't know, learning how to walk. And let me, I just got a quote from a movie, a Spanish movie, which is of handicapped people playing basketball, okay? And especially, I don't know how you say it in English, is a brain handicapped, okay? Yeah. And there's a coach in the movie that, well, he has to do some things for the community, okay? And he's assigned to coach that team. And on his first session, he goes onto court and he gets his boss and he says, man, these kids or these guys don't even know how to run. How do you want me to teach them basketball? And the guy he was talking to told him, okay, start from there. Teach them how to run. That was such a huge lesson for any coach. Is it doesn't matter the level you receive them. It's how you are going to help them achieve more.
Love that. Love that. Great story. And simply getting into this discussion then, Coach, about, again, some of the things that we used to teach that some people still teach, but probably we should look at the game and say, these things don't happen as much, or these things aren't exactly done in the same way we used to teach. And let's start with something, you know, from the base level, which is the chest pass. Why is the chest pass confusing nowadays in terms of coaching?
Okay, I've been teaching coaches for all my career, almost since in my first 3 years of coaching, I was already teaching other coaches. And this chest pass is one of the most confusing ones, probably because the name gets it into confusion. So I see coaches teach the chest pass starting at the chest level. So what they teach is that the elbows get out, okay, and you want to pass front. So there's no force aimed into the direction you want to pass. So when I tell those coaches, why do you teach the chest pass starting from the chest level? They tell me, because I was taught that way. And I say, okay, let's do this. Most of the times you teach this way, kids don't have the strength to get as long as you would desire when they pass or when they give a pass, a chest pass, okay? But why don't you try this? Instead of starting at the chest level, make the chest pass start at the belly level. So when you lower the ball to the belly, now your forearms are pointing or aiming in the direction you want to pass. So now you have something putting force in the same direction on the way you want to give the pass. Okay? And for me, the name of chest pass is because it ends at the chest level, not because it starts at the chest level. Sometimes it can start there, probably when you are stronger and probably with time, or maybe because you were taught that way when somebody taught you that. But it's much easier for somebody to pass, starting the pass at the belly level. It gives the kid more strength and he can coordinate more so he can get that pass longer instead of shorter. That's what usually coaches don't like.
And the other part of that is that the chest pass is not thrown mostly from the middle of the body at all anymore. Like, defense is too good and the game's too dynamic, and these chest passes are thrown outside the body and not within the body. So I love that location, and then the direction or the angle is different as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. I mean, nowadays, a good defense, and I used to say that I teach players to play against good defense. Okay, so a good defense won't let you hold the ball in front of yourself. It would make you hide the ball one of your sides of the body. So you will have to pass from your right side or from your left side. So usually when you give a pass from one side, it starts at the belly level. You don't bring it. And for me, it's a mistake to bring it at the chest level when you're passing with one hand. Okay, because once you start passing, once you start the action of passing, you cannot control the direction. Okay, so it's kind of, I usually say there, when you're passing from one side, it's like playing tennis. Okay, it's when you are hitting a drive. Okay, it's not chest level going front. It's like in tennis when you're hitting a drive. Okay, it's kind of side to side. So you can release the ball at any time from where your action starts to where your action ends. And that's the way you control the direction of the ball when you're passing with one hand.
Great breakdown. And, definitely with your coaching background and your coaching the coach's background, you can tell that you've deeply thought about these things. And another one comes to mind, which is the layup. Is that traditionally kids, especially in North America, they seem to be programmed at a very young age to shoot layups on top of their head. But the reality is you made the point already, playing against good defense, right? None of this matters against no defense, and none of this matters against bad defense to a certain extent. But against good defense, very rarely are you shooting it from the top of your head, and are you shooting it completely balanced off of, say, inside foot? So what are some of the things that you think about in terms of the layup?
Okay, the first one, and this is very important for me, especially at a pro level, but when you're teaching a kid, you try to bring him into his best, and if that's at the end, at the pro level, that's perfect. If not, he's having a good time, that's enough. But when you teach a layup without defense, usually the kid only gives the arc to the ball to get above the rim. Okay, so usually they make layups, or they play layups just a few centimeters away from the rim. Okay, but when you got defenses and good defenses, you gotta give the ball an enough arc so that you are not blocked. And usually that means taking the ball 1 meter above the rim than you're used to. Okay, so even when we're teaching young kids, we got to make them aware, even if you don't have any guy guarding you at that moment, that's how we usually teach when kids are beginning, try to give enough arc to the ball so the ball goes, let's say, far enough in the air above the rim, okay, to hit the goal of scoring, instead of just releasing it at the rim level, which usually, if you're able to do that, just go for a dunk when you are athletic enough, okay? If not, just try to release it high enough to avoid easy blocks.
Great stuff. Great stuff. And I align with so many of these things that we're going to bring up. And this one was a frustration for me as a young player, because I think it messed up my shot more than anything. And this concept that shooting feet must point to the basket. And that to me always related to the elbow. That people always said, oh, you have to shoot with your elbow in. But my natural and most comfortable anatomy was not having my elbow in, and it was turning my feet slightly. Can you talk about shooting relative to some of the things that you've rethought about?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. This is two different things for me.
Absolutely.
Okay. The first one is that for sure we teach new players how to get squared, how the elbow has to be in, how everything has to be, in a perfect 90 degree angle. Okay. But let's say that that's the perfect option. But everybody is different. Okay. So to adjust that perfection to a kid's reality. Okay, so if a kid, because the way he's built, needs to take the elbow a little bit out, just let him do it. The good thing is he has to be relaxed. Okay, for sure there are some limits. You cannot go with an elbow too much outside of your body, but slightly out, that's not a problem. You need him to feel relaxed when he shoots, okay? And if he's very uncomfortable when he brings his elbow in, just let him slightly take that elbow out. So usually, when they're the first option, when they're not comfortable bringing the elbow in, one of the things I was taught is, okay, you slightly turn your feet instead of both pointing to the rim, just turn them slightly, like a 30 degree, so now your shoulders will be a little bit more relaxed and now your elbow can come in, okay? But the thing is that because of the way I was taught this, I was taught that every time your feet should be aiming or pointing to the basket when you take a shot. And I was watching different players, especially in the low post. When they, if you're right-handed, when you play a fadeaway from the low post, I watch a lot of players that I said when they shoot, they do not have their feet pointing to the basket. And I thought to myself, what's the goal of having your feet pointing to the basket? The goal of having your feet pointing to the basket is that your elbow should be pointing to the basket. So if you're right-handed and you are on the right part of the court and you go, I don't know, with a stop, left foot, right foot to aim to the basket, the only way your elbow can point to the basket is that both feet are almost pointing to the basket. But if you're on the other side, you are right-handed, you are on the left side of the court, your feet can be pointing to the corner that you can also point your elbow to the basket. And if your elbow is pointing to the basket, you can take a shot. You don't need your feet completely pointing to the basket. So especially this makes sense, okay, in the low post. And this is a problem I find with Spanish coaches when they teach young kids. They tell them to turn all the way on the low post so their feet point to the basket. And that way, when they're on the left side of the of offense and they're right-handed, they offer the ball to defense. So in order to protect playing a fadeaway, you can play the fadeaway pointing your feet towards baseline. Doesn't matter if they're pointing to the basket, that you can even take that shot as long as your shooting elbow is clearly pointing to the basket. Okay, so this is something I changed in the way I taught or in the way I teach, because I was taught one way, but now thinking about basketball or the basketball I see things are performed in other ways. So I gotta adjust, or I usually learn from the good players. And this is something I teach my young coaches to do. If you hesitate whether to teach one thing or not, watch good players. Do they do it? If they do it, go ahead, teach it. If nobody does it, or only one player in the whole world does it, then take care, be careful. Because maybe that's not the best way of teaching something. Okay?
Absolutely, no. And so many things come to mind for me, but the one being, the closer you get to the basket, the less you need to have your feet squared. Like, it's absolutely a true part of that. And your post example is wonderful to be able to bring that home. So really good stuff. And do you get into much discussion about footwork? Like, what's the ideal footwork? Is there a perfect footwork? I suspect no, from my opinion, but what do you think?
Well, footwork is very important. Is there a perfect thing? It's like shooting, a perfect picture of how it should be. But now you got to adapt to the players you have, how their body built, okay? And not everybody has the same skills, okay? So you gotta get used to it. I mean, it's not the same watching, I don't know, Hakeem Olajuwon playing in the low post, okay, than watching Kevin McHale. Were they both very good? For sure, they're very good, but they're different. They move their feet inside very differently. So the thing is that what you do, it helps you achieve your goal. And if it helps you achieve your goal, that's good enough, okay? Does it have to be perfect in terms of if you don't do it like Hakeem Olajuwon, you are not doing it right? No. You can be more like another player, and if that helps you achieve your goal, which is, I don't know, keep a stance position, so when you're shooting your hook, you're in a good situation to score, that's good enough for you. So go with it. Okay, and there are different circumstances that will make you teach one kid one way and another kid in another way. And for me, and this is very important, we teach basketball is a team sport. Okay, it's a group sport. But in the way I think basketball right now, playing as a team is very important, but you got to differentiate every player in the team. So you got to teach them as a team, but at the same time, you got to teach them individually with everybody having its own circumstances, and you got to adapt to all your 12 players. You do not correct the same thing to all your 12 players. And maybe you are correcting opposite things to one and to other. The thing is that the advice you give every player helps them become a better player.
Love it. And couldn't agree more. Absolutely a great way of saying it. So, Coach, what are some things defensively that maybe we don't think about in the same way anymore, and some things that you were taught that maybe you go, that isn't exactly okay. True.
Well, I usually relate a lot the quotes or the sentences, how we use the language, okay? How language impacts the way we teach, okay? And here, at least here in Spain, there's a quote that says that you play defense with your legs, and I don't believe that anymore, okay? And I don't believe that anymore watching American basketball. Okay, why? Why I say this, and I gotta tell you so you can understand.
Please.
Legs bring you where your body and your arms can play defense. They translate you from one point to other. The part of your body that plays defense is your chest and your arms. You cannot play defense with your legs. Your legs only transport you, and it's a very important part. But you don't play defense with your legs. If you play very well with your legs, but you don't learn how to raise your hand to contest a shot, use your hands to try to steal a ball, use your hands so the opponent hides the ball where you want him to hide it, or, I don't know, how to block a shot, all those kind of stuff, it doesn't matter how quick you are with your legs. Okay? So what I teach my coaches is legs bring or translate you from one point to other, to where your hands and your body can play real defense.
And Coach, is there something about that we overemphasize being low? Like if I think about a defender, especially covering the ball, we always talk about this center of gravity, this ideal squat position. But when I look at a good defender cover the ball, their head and their shoulders are often in front of their feet. They're not that low relative to what we think. And they definitely don't slide as much as they sprint and recover. Are those things too that you think about?
I don't believe in sliding.
Yes.
You just said it. It was your words. We don't slide as much as we run and recover.
Absolutely.
So let's say when I was taught, okay, the typical drill, okay, you keep your hands behind your back and you go with your legs. That for me, it's absolutely wrong. First, because when you have your hands behind your back, your center of gravity gets out from where it should be. Your hands in front of your body help you keep the center of gravity in front of you. Okay, and when you're leaning a little bit, when you're just getting low and leaning your back a little bit front, okay, your center of gravity, and this is physics, gets out of your body in front of your belly. But if you take your hands back, okay, so you teach your players how to slide, you are making the player adopt a position that he's never going to adopt playing a real game. Okay? So in these terms, I teach my players, of course, I teach sliding, but only two steps, two sliding steps, no more. Because even, and this is something funny I usually run in my clinics, okay? I'm 50 years old, or almost 50, I'm 49, okay? I'm chubby. I have my belly is big enough, okay? And I have athletes running my drills. And I tell them, okay, let's run a test. You run sliding the whole court, 28 meters, against me, run in front. I run like usual, but you got to run sliding. Who do you think is going to win the race? The 49 chubby guy or the athlete? And they all say, no, you're going to win it. So I always ask them, then why do you want to slide? Just like,
yeah.
For me, why we slide? We slide when we want to force a contact with our body that is not seen by the referees like a defensive foul. That's when we want to slide. So does it make sense to slide full court? For me, no, nothing. Unless you want to force an offensive foul on a particular spot, okay? That's not usually the case, okay? So I got to get you ready to run with the ball. Not sliding in front of the ball. Because this 49 savvy guy is going to run faster than you if I go, I run fronting like usual and you run sliding laterally.
There's no question. And that comes back to athleticism and biomechanics
and all those things, you know, and we'll get into a really fun one too, which is the closeout. Like, do we overcomplicate the closeout? Like, it's running and stopping, right? What are some ideas that you teach with the closeout?
Right now, this is a great point, especially in professional basketball.
Yeah.
Okay. Why? Because I was taught to run against the ball and at the end take very short steps, right?
Yep.
So you call the penetration, right? Okay, now, nowadays, let somebody shoot the three. It's done. It's over. They're going to kill you on the three-point line. So nowadays, I tell my players, you go and take short steps at the end, you're going to leave the three-pointer. So my rule, it's my rule. I don't have to be perfect. And I know that there are great coaches in Europe, okay, that keep teaching this way, and they're very good, okay? I'm not telling that this is my truth right now, okay? But what I tell my players is, I want to run and step at the three-point line as quick as possible because I want to force the offense to put the ball on the floor. I don't want them taking easy three-pointers. And if you take short steps at the end to make the closeout, he's going to take the easy three-pointer. You're going to protect from the penetration. Nowadays, basketball is won at the three-point line and under the basket. Okay? So if you leave three-pointers, you're done. You're dead. So I got to teach you how to arrive much closer to that situation so you don't leave easy three-pointers. Okay? And if the offense puts the ball on the floor to attack with a penetration, we'll see how we help you. Okay, but I was thinking, let the Warriors shoot threes.
Yeah. And again, this is just something, I mean, the
modern game is teaching us, but the players are teaching us too, right? About how to teach these things and how to present these things differently. And do you still see a lot of traditional teaching of these concepts that we've talked about? Is that still something that you see a lot of in Spain and with some of the coaches you work with?
Every single day.
Yeah, me too.
Every single day. But I got to tell you, the very good coaches, they're changing. Mm-hmm. Most of them are changing the way they teach. Okay, so the battle is to teach those guys that are still taught in an old-fashioned way, the new fashion, the new ways of doing things. And I usually tell them, okay, don't believe me, but don't believe what you get taught. Just put everything you receive through your own filter and make your own decisions as a coach. Okay, instead of listening only to one voice, listen to different voices and you make your decision what you want to teach. Okay, and again, if you see a lot of very good coaches doing one thing, that's for sure because there's a good reason to do it. And we always learn copying. So don't be afraid to copy. But copy from the good ones, not from the bad ones.
Well, I mentioned to you just off air that I had a chance to watch your practice and I had a chance to watch Real Madrid with Pablo Laso. And when I left those practices, when I was on my trip around the world, those are two practices that left an impression on me and confirmed for me that what I was doing was right, which is there was a lot of 5-on-5 within the practice. It wasn't all high intensity 5-on-5. And that's where I say slow learning 5-on-5 is better than fast learning 5-on-0. And I saw that in your practice and then Pablo's practice. Is that a philosophy as well that comes through, whether it's from Real Madrid or from you, or where does that come from? And is that something that you see a lot of?
Okay, I don't know where it comes from. I was with Pablo Laso 3 years in Real Madrid. I also was with Ettore Messina 2 years in Real Madrid and before with other very good coaches. Of course, I teach some things in 5-on-0, okay? But basketball is played 5-on-5. So there has to be a point where you got to play against defense. If everything you run is 5-against-0, your players won't know how to react against different situations on defense. Not everybody plays the same way of playing defense. So you got to get used to any way of getting defended, okay? And the way of doing that is playing I don't know, okay, you're talking about 5-on-5, it can be played on 4-on-4 or 3-on-3, but a lot of time with opposition. That's rhythm. You were talking to me before, you were asking, what's the difference? Why Spanish basketball can compete with anybody? And I was telling you, well, we're good competitors, okay? And probably that's because we run a lot of situations where we don't run so much things against zero, but things against defense. It can be a controlled defense, or it can be a real defense, but it's always against something that can make decisions and that moves. So you gotta make your own reactions. Okay, and that's important for me. And right now, I'll tell you something, something funny. At the age of 48, I started playing guitar. I'm learning to play guitar. My teacher in guitar, he says, and this is something that I can apply to basketball. When you're changing chords, if you're not quick enough, slow the tempo down so your fingers can make it on time.
Great, great example of slow learning. But you're still playing guitar.
Yeah, not too good. Yeah. Not very good, not very well, but yeah, I'm playing guitar. Yeah, for sure. I'm improving every day. And but that was a great advice. It was, I know, okay, this song is played at this tempo. Okay, you want to learn it? Your fingers don't get in time on the chords? Okay, don't worry. Slow the tempo. It's going to sound a little bit slower, but you are going to be able to recognize the music. Okay, and try it, any song. Try to sing it slower than you usually do. It's still music. It's still something that you recognize. And as soon as you get used to it and your fingers get used to that tempo, increase the tempo and do it faster. And next time faster until you are able to run it or to play it at the right tempo.
No, I mean, and you're describing the learning process in my mind. And a lot of this, the science, the evidence to this comes back to that it's the perceptual demands that we lack when we do it on air. And when you're doing it in this offense versus defense situation, you're going to more likely transfer because your players are seeing the perceptual demands both on offense and defense. And that's the relevance of what you're saying. So small-sided games, coach, that's a big part of teaching these 3-on-3, these 4-on-4, and different things throughout the Spanish system as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As I told you, everything with opposition, and it can be a control opposition. Let me explain this. Of course, if you make a player that doesn't have enough individual skills to beat a defender, a real defender, okay, you can limit the defense. I mean, you can limit the way he can move. Let's say this. Instead of playing against a cone, you can play against a defender that has to move his feet both together at the same time. So that's more difficult for the defender. So it's easier for offense, but offense has to react to the reaction of the defender that can still move. It's not a cone. A cone doesn't move. A cone is a space. It's an empty space. We don't play against empty spaces. We gotta create empty spaces when we're playing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And using guidance or different things like that in terms of guided defense and these progressions of learning like that are important too. But coach, you're saying there's not much done on air, done without defense. How do you approach then skill development? And I know you do some stuff where you do some work with coaches, and I've seen you work with young kids in some of the clinics that I've seen online as well. If you were to go back and teach a young player something new, how would you start that teaching?
Look, the way that our brain learns, it's copying, imitate. We imitate since we're babies, okay? And the ability that our brain has to imitate something is huge. It's huge. The thing is that we limit it, okay? Since we talk, and I think this is kind of strange, the way we communicate is language, okay? A spoken language. But when you gotta teach something through language, it's got to be taught on a sequence. Something goes first, then the second, then this third. But that's not really how the brain learns. The brain learns from complete situations. Think of a kid, okay, a baby. When a baby starts speaking its first words, they don't know about the letters. They don't know even about the words. They try to find a solution to ask for mom, for dad, for water, okay? Or to say, this is mine, okay? So they try to control the general thing. And they start building sentences when they learn to talk without knowing the individual parts of what they're talking. But they know that the meaning of what they're saying makes sense for them. Okay? So when you imitate, when, I don't know, let's say this. I want you to learn a layup. And now we have, nowadays, we have all this technology, like the phone where you can show a video. You got your iPad where you can show a video. Okay? You can be, as a coach, the one making the example of how to make a layup, or you can put a video and show your kids how another kid or how a player does a layup, and then you tell them, try to imitate it. Don't focus on something in particular. Just try to imitate it, and then every kid will act differently. And now, once you see what the good things they're doing on that imitation, you start correcting wherever you should correct individually, because some kids are gonna imitate perfectly, I don't know, the hand, but they're gonna go wrong with their feet. Or some of them are gonna go okay with their feet, but they don't know how to do it with their hands. Okay, so now you start to make them focus on the things you want them to solve. And again, you can do it giving them the solution or forcing them to focus on what they're doing wrong. So let me explain. Let's say that they're not doing well, the two steps for a layup, okay? And instead of saying him, okay, go left, then right this way, let's say that you told them to imitate a player, you say now, okay, watch this player again. Focus on his feet and try to imitate his feet, okay? And see how they react to that new imitation, okay? And you're gonna discover that a lot of times, if you give them enough time, they're gonna do much better than when you tell them exactly what to do when you're teaching. Well, that's my point of view.
Yeah, no, it's tremendous. It's absolutely true. And the other advantage of what you're saying is that then we don't know what to teach them until they've tried it. Until they've done it. And that's so important. And too often we waste so much time and so much progression with these unnecessary progressions when we can just go, okay, go do it, try it, and then we'll figure out what we need to teach you. And as you've said already, that's very individual.
Absolutely. Look, Pablo Laso's son, one of his sons, the youngest one, he's incredible for sports. And when he was a very young kid, he was playing soccer and he was playing basketball. And his ability to imitate, he just had to see something on TV. Then he went to the park, to a court on the park. Without being taught by anybody, he was imitating what he saw on TV. Now, as a coach, when you see him doing something, okay, when you see that kid doing something, then you say, okay, he does this pretty well. Now I'm going to focus on this, that he's not doing that well. But now I know that this can be handled by him, okay? If you just start, okay, where do we start to teach? And this is a great question for coaches, you see? What do you start teaching? Let's say that you decide that you start teaching passing, okay? Let's say that. Which pass do you explain first and why? And there's no right answer. It would be let them pass, just tell them to pass, see how they do it, and make a decision what you want to teach first based on what you see when you tell them to do something. Instead of, okay, I'm going to start with the chest pass because I was taught that way.
I love it.
You see the difference?
Absolutely. I'm on board. And for coaches that are interested, you can Google Daniel Cole, Stare to Win, the talent code, because he adds some of the evidence-based research behind this as well. This concept of imitating and staring and everything else. So, coach, you're speaking my language. I love this. And I think we wanted to get into a little bit too is this concept of the floater. And it's an advanced skill, so to speak. But is that something that's being taught at a pretty young age in the Spanish system?
Well, it's being taught right now. When I was young, the floater did not exist here in Spain.
Right.
Okay. But then we have Navarro, who played in the NBA 1 year. and in Memphis, okay? But he's one of the, he got retired last year, okay? He's one of the players from our 80 generation, okay, 1980 generation. He's one of the best players in history in Spanish basketball. And he started playing with floaters. And he tells you why he starts playing with floaters. Because when he arrived into the pro team in Barcelona, he had Roberto Dueñas, who was a 220. I don't know, in feet, it should be, well, I don't know. You make the translation, okay?
Yeah, it's 220. I don't know. Okay? People can Google it.
Yeah, it should, I don't know, 7'5" or something like that. I don't know. It's a lot. Okay, so when I wanted to shoot over him, regular layups were not the way to do it. Okay, and Dueñas was not only the only big guy on court. I had Fuca, 215. I had a lot of different players that forced me to play over them. And I found this way of going over them, the floater. Okay, so now you got one of the best players in Spanish basketball history shooting floaters, both with his left hand and his right hand. So now kids that were never taught to shoot floaters were imitating. So now we coaches learn, if they're imitating, why don't we teach it? And in Spain, we're starting teaching floaters because of Juan Carlos Navarro.
And that's great. And you talked about the broken wrist, like that it's not the same follow through as shooting.
Yeah, this is something I was told to give a clinic of one of the Spanish courses for coaches. And the thing I had to talk about was shooting, okay? But it was the highest level of coaching. So I said, I cannot go and just talk about regular shooting that these coaches already know. So I was trying to find, as I told you, I learned from the best. I learned from watching the best, okay? So I watched a video about the best 100 floaters in the NBA. And I found out that when we talked, we were teaching about the breaking the wrist, the what you call in the USA, I think you call it the follow-through. Okay,
yeah.
Or when you're shooting. Yeah, when you're shooting, it's we call it here breaking your wrist. Okay, so I said, but when I see floaters, I got the feeling nobody finished the gesture. They stopped halfway. So I got this video, okay? I got the what somebody said was the best 100 floaters in NBA. And I just watched it. From 100, only one broke the wrist. All the other 99 were holding the wrist halfway. And I said, if the best are not going all the way with the wrist, why should we teach it?
Makes sense. From what you see, players teach us so much.
That's it. That's it.
Yeah, players teach us so much about what they actually do. And players play the game more than we play the game. So they're figuring out solutions that we haven't even thought about often. And most of that comes back to, are you putting them in those situations where they're allowed to figure out solutions? And that's coming back full circle to what you said in the beginning about allowing them to make mistakes and find solutions.
Okay, let me talk for young coaches about this. Okay, at least here in Spain, when I was young, we played basketball at school on break times. Here in Spain, you got, I don't know, 2 or 3 hours of class, then you got a break. It could be 1 hour or half an hour where we went out to the basketball courts and we played basketball, or other kids played football or soccer or whatever. Okay, then we get back to the class. And again, after 2 or 3 hours of classes, we got another break. Okay, so we played basketball on those breaks. When you were playing basketball at school on those breaks, you were playing basketball on the same basket. We were playing, I don't know, 2 or 3 games at the same time because there were not baskets enough for everybody. Or even you may be playing basketball where at the same time, crossed, you had a soccer game going on. So what happened? You were always reacting to what was surrounding you. It can be a soccer ball coming into your face. It can be somebody else playing another game, but was in your same court, okay? And when we went into practice, it didn't matter if we played a lot of individual things, 1 against 0, because our perception of what was going on was taught at the break times at school, when we played by ourselves our games. Nowadays, kids do not play any longer at the breaks at school. Okay. They just stare at the technology. That's okay. I'm not saying that's wrong or that's right. But now when they get into court, you're the coach, you got to accept that they're not improving the way they can hold everything. Okay. Because they're not set into those stimuli. Okay. That we were when we were playing on the playground. Okay, so you gotta teach differently. You cannot teach everything 1-0 because they're not playing on the playground any longer. So you gotta do the job we did when we were younger, playing 4 games at the same time in the same basket. Okay, now you gotta reproduce things where they can control what's going on around them and not only play things against zero. So now I relate this to what we were talking before during the podcast, okay? And we were saying that, okay, you can play against zero. You're going to be very skilled. You're going to be very skilled against nobody.
No, it's great. And it's not a generational weakness. It's a reality, right? So yeah. We have to adapt. We have to adapt as coaches to be able to, again, put our players in the best situation to be able to develop and to help our teams win in terms of those things. Coach, is there something else that comes to mind as one of these things that we used to teach or we used to think differently about, but now it's not?
Yeah, when you first, that not every coach coaches to bring players to pro level. Only one out of 100,000 makes it to the pro level. So most of us are working for kids to have fun, to improve their basketball, to become better, but just to become better. Okay, we're not working to create professionals. When a player becomes a professional, that's great. But it's not because everybody's working to bring up professionals. You understand what I mean?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely.
But now, let's say that you're in a place, here in Spain, we work in clubs, okay? And every professional club has his under 18, under 16, under 14 teams. It's mandatory to have them, okay? So when we work for these kids, this is very important. What I think that brings them to the pro level is their offense skills. I haven't seen anybody, unless it's something physical, like he's 220, or he's a very, 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 very good athlete, okay? The ones that make it to the pro level are the ones that are able to score easily, okay? But, and this is the point, once they make it to the pro level, once they reach into the professional coach hands, unless they are able to play good defense, they don't have a single minute on court. So what's the message? Work for those kids to be better on offense, but you got to take care of their defense. If not, you're not helping them.
And really, when you're saying defense in that context, you're talking about the value of defense and connecting it to, again, the big picture. But we should be developing offense, right? At the youth level, skill equals confidence. We need to spend more time on offensive skill. And at the youth level, less time on defense and defensive technique and defensive drills, because defense at the end of the day is about habits and effort and value. And we can develop that while we're building offense, can't we?
The thing is, for me, why does a kid come to play basketball? When he first arrives to a basketball court and he says, okay, I'm going to get into the basketball team because he wants to score.
Absolutely. It's not because they want to get in a stance and play defense. It's not because they want to rebound. They want to shoot. They want to shoot.
That's the first thing they want to do with the ball.
Yeah.
Okay. If they find a ball on the playground, they catch it and shoot. They don't go around the ball, around the ball sliding. Okay. That's absolutely true. Okay. Now, when you have something, one player against the other, two against two, three against three, four against three, doesn't matter. It can be with advantage. Okay. You're always playing two things. You're playing offense or you're playing defense. You always play both sides of the court. And the only way of improving your teammate on offense, that's our goal, is that you become a better defender. So you put him in more trouble than you would be able to put him if you don't perform your defense.
So I've believed this for a long time, so I'm so happy you said it that way too, is that using offense versus defense in the majority of your practice intentionally and unintentionally makes your defense better because of this active participation that the defender has in helping the offense get better. I love that. It's such an important part of this. And that's something that I try and sell. The other part that I try and convince coaches of is that in playing the game and practice offense versus defense, it also makes you a better coach because you're used to now identifying situations that would come up in a game. Is that something that you thought about and think about and share?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with what you said. When coaches, young coaches tell me, so what do I have to teach, offense or defense? Both.
Yeah.
You got to grow them at the same time. Because if you don't grow them at the same time, offense, let's say that you don't pay attention to defense, okay? And I will go with another thing about related to defense. If you don't pay attention to defense, maybe with two good skills from offensive part are enough to beat you and score, okay? So if you don't force that player to use different skills because you improve your defense, you are not helping him to grow. Because let's say that every time I take, I don't know, a crossover left to right, I beat you, okay? I won't do anything else. If that's enough for me, I will always do the same. So what I need to perform a better offense, that you're able to stop my crossover left to right. If you're able to stop my signature move, I gotta learn something else. Maybe while I'm playing my crossover, now I get a change behind my back. You're forcing me to be better. But if every time that I do the same thing, you cannot stop me, I will keep doing the same thing every single day. And then I will think I'm very good until I find somebody out of the team when we're playing against another team that can stop that, and I won't know what to do with the ball. You understand what I mean?
Yeah, no, because it's exactly what you said at the beginning, that this is
them solving problems. And when the defense solves a problem, the offense has to find a different or novel solution. And that's what the learning process is.
That's it.
Yeah.
Coach, this is tremendous stuff. And
we couldn't be more aligned in so many of these ideas. And
because if not, I'm going to forget. I'm an old guy right now. Okay. And look, and I think you said something about it, if I understood right. We usually say that defense is easier than offense. Because offense is a skill-related ability, okay? And defense is more about heart. I do not agree.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Heart has to be on both parts of the court. Okay? Sometimes there's a quote or sentence here in Spain that says that defense is 10% skill, 90% heart. Okay? And I say, okay, go on offense with a 90% skill and only 10% of heart. And let's see what you got.
To clarify, I did not say it was about heart. No, I definitely agree with what you're saying. And that, again, it's an oversimplification. That's what we tend to do sometimes with these lists and these different things we post on social media of it's this, this, and this, and then you're a good player. And I say to all young players, the way that you've said it, which is get as skilled as you can on offense. And then the other parts, if you're in the right system or you're playing basketball, those other parts are going to evolve. And I love this idea. So, Coach, within your program and within some of these, the development programs leading up to the senior team, is this something, if a coach would come over and watch development within Spain, would they be seeing this at all levels?
Well, there are coaches that do and coaches that don't. Okay, I like the ones that learn. And right. The ones that come over and watch your practices, and especially not only the ones that come and watch, but they ask at the end, Coach, why did you do this? I see what you're doing. The thing is, the big thing is, why are you doing this? Because it's not about just copying for the sake of copying. That's a way of doing things, okay? And I told you before during the podcast, okay? But it's also understanding why a particular coach is doing a particular thing at a particular time. And once you know or you understand the whys, now you can think of maybe I can translate part of what I saw into my team because I understand the whys they're doing it. Or understanding the whys tells me this is not the thing to do in my team because the whys he's giving to this thing has nothing to do with what I'm trying to teach my team. Okay?
And I suspected that was the answer or something in that way. So then the other part, the follow-up to that is then, since not everybody approaches it this way, how do you present it to coaches that are resistant to looking at a different way of teaching than, say, traditional methods? How do you communicate to those coaches the importance of looking at these things?
I know that you in the USA, you're a different culture than in Europe. And I there are a lot of things that I like from USA culture. Okay, one of these is something I read related to marketing just yesterday. Okay, it's you can go and try different things yourself and learn by attempting an error. Okay, but there's a faster way of doing things. Get a mentor. Get a good mentor. Get someone that has already gone through it. Okay, so for the ones that don't ask the whys, I would tell them, yeah, you can learn and you're going to improve. Testing and committing errors. Okay, you're going to improve for sure. Probably slower that you can do it if you go and ask and you understand what's behind.
Well, and coach, I'm available for coaches. You're available for coaches. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I started sharing the game and sharing basketball immersion and sharing some of these ideas with coaches. And I've been blessed and grateful and humbled to be able to do this with so many coaches already. And I know you do as well. Can you talk about some of the mentorship you do within Spain and within outside of Spain as well that's available to coaches?
Yeah, well, I got a mentorship program, but I only have one or two coaches at the same time. Right now, because of my duties as a professional coach, it's a little bit stopped, although I'm having one coach mentor right now. Okay, and that's something I didn't promote. I know I have it on my webpage, but my webpage is not seen too much. Okay, so it's mouth to mouth. And when someone comes and asks a lot of things, then I tell them about this mentoring program. What I do is just try to give advice to young coaches and even not so young coaches. I remember, without saying the name, it doesn't matter. I got a professional coach who I mentor. He was coaching a female, not in Spain, abroad. Okay. And well, it was a great experience for this coach because he was sending me the videos of their practices or their games, and we broke it down and we just analyzed whatever he wanted to analyze. And this is important. It's not what I want to teach. It's what do you need from me? Okay, so if I'm able to help you in what you need help, I'll tell you my advice about the things you want to learn. If I'm not able to help you, I will tell you directly. Okay, let's say I'm not a physical trainer. If you're going to ask me about physical training, I will say you get a physical trainer. I'm not a physical trainer. But if you're going to ask me about tactical things, about spacing, about, fundamental skills and all that kind of stuff, then I can help you. How? You send me your videos and I will see them with you. It's not that I break it down and then I send them to you. No, we will watch it at the same time. Technology lets us right now share a video at any time. You in New York and me in Madrid, we can be watching a video at the same time, okay, and talking about what we see. That's the way I mentor my coaches. It's, okay, you are doing this. I usually ask, okay, why are you doing this? And once I receive the answer, I usually tell them, okay, if you try to do this, you tell me what happens. So they work it during the week. And after, 1 week, 2 weeks, we get back. And he tells me, okay, I coach this, and this is improving, this is not improving. You watch the game with me again, and we watch things, we review them, and I keep advising them. For now, I had kind of 8 or 9 coaches being mentored during the last years with me, and they're all happy, okay? They're very happy. But right now, I don't have enough time to have more than one at the same time because I have my own duties with my team, and I gotta solve my problems. That's what I get paid, okay?
Absolutely. And coaches, I obviously encourage you to go check out all coaches' stuff. He's got a ton of stuff online, ton of clinics, and he's on Twitter and everything else as well. But Yeah, it's such a great example. I mean, in our BI Platinum, where I get to do some of that firsthand video of practices and interacting with the coach and talking to them directly about what they're trying to do and how they're trying to do it. I mean, it's just so much more impactful. And I'm grateful to be able to do some of that as well. And then the other thing you said is about older coaches. Coach, within our program, we've had so many coaches, you know, 50, 60 year olds in our program just saying, I wish I was coached this way, or I wish I knew this when. But it's never too late. That's a beautiful thing about learning, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Look, and one thing that happens, there are a lot of coaches that when they see a clinic, or when they attend a course where I'm teaching them, they say, man, you changed my mind, but now I'm confused. I don't know what to teach. See, yep. It's like, it's so new, so much new information that I don't know where to start right now. And I always say, don't worry. Do your best with the knowledge you have right now, and always pretending to improve your players. If you do that you do your best with the knowledge you have right now, with the goal of improving your team or your players, you're never going to be wrong. And probably next year, you're going to have a bigger knowledge. And you will look behind and you will say, man, how I was doing this? I was wrong. No, you weren't wrong at that moment. You're just improving. So the goal is, don't stop. Start moving. And you will improve as a coach. Don't try to compare yourself, if you're a young coach, with coaches that have been coaching for, I don't know, for 30, 40 years. You're not going to be like them. Okay? You got to walk your own path. Okay? Just start moving, improve your players. If you do those three things I tell you, you will never be wrong. Never. Never.
Love it. Because learning is non-linear for coaches, just like it is for players. And for me, it's why my membership to Basketball Immersion is a full year. Because if you just do it for a month, or you do it for a few weeks, or you do it for a 7-day trial, you're not investing, you're not immersing yourself in it. And by the end of the year, you can have a better feel for whether this is your path or not. So I just love how you said so much of that, Coach.
I love that word, immersing. You cannot immerse in anything for 1 week.
No, you can't.
You try to learn a new language. Let's say an American guy tries to learn his Spanish in Madrid, and he does it immersing in Madrid. You're not going to learn Spanish in 1 week. You got to be here 1 year, immersed in Madrid. Love in 1 week, okay, you learn two phrases. Perfect. In 1 month, okay, I don't know. You will know how to ask for a coffee at a restaurant, okay? But if you really want to learn Spanish, you got, or if I want to learn English, okay, I got to go to the States, to New York, or to whatever city, okay, and stay there for a whole year. And if it's 2 years, the better. The more English I'm going to learn. The more I immerse in something, the better I become on it.
Well said, Coach. Well said. And I encourage so many coaches to immerse themselves in the ACB League and to watch not just your team, but the whole league. It's just tremendous basketball and tremendous way to be able to challenge your thinking if you're not used to watching that style of basketball as well. So, Coach, we wish you a tremendous year, and we really appreciate you taking the time. And I know there'll be a lot of coaches reaching out to you, but we'll also reach out to you because we'll be excited to have you back on the podcast someday.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.